From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
With more than 2 weeks before the Illinois primary, the GOP race for governor is already looking pretty lopsided. A new WBEZ Chicago Sun-Times poll finds State Senator Darren Bailey with a nearly 2-1 lead over his next closest rival, Aurora Mayor Richard Irvin. And that's despite Irvin getting $50 million in contributions this year from Chicago hedge fund tycoon Kenneth Griffin.
As Darren Bailey pulls ahead of Richard Irvin in a new poll, the Irvin team is pulling his downstate ads for next week. Changing course this late in the race is raising a lot of questions.
Despite the $45 million in funding from billionaire Ken Griffin, Richard Irvin's team will not air TV ads downstate next week. Irvin's faced a record-setting number of negative ads from Governor Pritzker.
He's on track to spend close to $35 million in the Republican primary, so I don't cross that finish line first.
Well, the primary election will be over in just a couple of weeks, and the Republican leading in fundraising seems to be losing ground in some of the polls that we've seen. Richard Irvin also changing his strategy here in the final days, and we'll discuss that and more on this episode of State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Professor Emeritus and former Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime State House reporter and observer. Also with us, we have Hannah Meisel, NPR Illinois State House Editor. And joining us today, Jerry Nowicki. He's the Bureau Chief for Capital News Illinois. And Jerry, it's always good to have you back with us.
Yeah, it's always good to be here, Sean.
Well, Jerry, I'll go to you first. In fact, just this morning, as we sat down to record this show, a WBEZ Chicago Sun-Times poll released shows Senator Darren Bailey with a sizable lead, 15 points over Irvin, and the other candidates are trailing those two. The polls aren't always right, but this probably is not good news for the Irvin campaign, especially at this point in the election season.
Yeah, it's a staggering number and a staggering sort of shift from the polling we saw recently. I think the most recent nonpartisan poll really was WGN that had Irvin in the lead by about 5 or 6 points. So, I mean, your mind goes to how did it shift so quickly? And Irvin saw a lot of heat for just sort of trying to dance around the issues and sort of maybe not be as in his convictions, as strong in his convictions as you see Darren Bailey is every single day and every single speech he makes, whether you agree with it or not. So you combine that with the Griffin money that's attacking Bailey pretty erroneously as having ties to Obama. I mean, anyone who's paid loose attention to state government in recent years has seen that, you know, Darren Bailey is a pretty staunchly conservative guy. He got kicked off the House floor because he refused to wear a mask at one point. So you know who Darren Bailey is, but did the Irvin strategy of sort of trying to remain undefined really turn himself off with voters to a point of irreparable harm? I don't know. It remains to be seen. There's still a lot of time until Election Day, but these are very bad numbers for his camp if they reflect reality.
And Charlie, the thing I thought that's when you delve into the numbers even a little bit more and you look is that according to this poll, Bailey leading by a good chunk in the suburban areas as well. I mean, Irvin's not even winning in basically his home territory.
Yeah, and that to me was the most surprising thing, because the assumption all along was that Richard Irvin would clean up in the suburbs and he would not fare well downstate, the area outside the Chicago metropolitan area, because of some of his hardline stances. And if this poll is accurate, apparently that's not the case. Apparently, Richard Irvin is having a hard time convincing staunch Republican voters that he should be their nominee to run against J.B. Pritzker. And some of the analysis that was in the Sun-Times BEZ story had voters saying, that they really didn't like the fact that Richard Ervin appears to be someone who's being propped up by this super billionaire, and they're not really sure what does Ervin stand for. Does he stand for whatever Ken Griffin's going to whisper in his ear? There was also some concern that Ervin, and this has been highlighted in some of the negative advertising, Ervin, for all intents and purposes, was a Democrat up until the time that he was tapped to be the GOP candidate for governor. And so those things kind of stood out to me. And the fact that I think one of the respondents told the pollsters, well, we know who Darren Bailey is. He's a genuine conservative. He's a genuine Donald Trump guy. And I suppose, as we've mentioned before on the show, what would seal it for Darren Bailey would be if Donald Trump goes ahead and endorses him. And given the former president's track record, this poll might be enough to convince Trump, well, Bailey's going to win, so I'll go ahead and endorse him so I don't have to run the danger of getting embarrassed again when one of my endorsed candidates gets creamed.
Yeah, Hannah, there's always this idea, I think, in the primaries, if you're a Democrat, you run to the left, a Republican, you run to the right, and then you try to run more in the middle for the general election. Well, it seems as though Ervin has done this a little bit backwards, where he is trying to run, you know, play it down the middle, try not to, you know, anger people who might be more moderate, who might be disenchanted Democrats who would come over and vote for him. If you believe the polling right now, that doesn't seem to be paying off.
The last time that in Illinois, at least, we saw this work well was with Bruce Rauner in 2014. While he did espouse a lot of anti-public sector union stuff in the primary, Democrats who actually did cross over and vote for him in the general election, you know, it could have been a, you know, maybe he doesn't actually mean it. Maybe that was just primary rhetoric. Of course, it turned out to be exactly what he meant. And of course, we saw a 2-year budget impasse as a kind of corollary result of that. But since 2014, the political world has changed, you know, especially on the Republican side, and that's owed mainly to the emergence of Donald Trump. The party has changed in ways that, like, I'm not sure that we'll ever truly understand, at least not while we're still living it, but all of the ways in which Trump and his acolytes have changed the Republican Party. So Richard Ervin was trying to follow that same kind of playbook, you know, I think in a different time it could have worked for him. When he would not, you know, embrace positions and would not answer questions, it's just, you know, I also think that he's had times that were, you know, captured by TV cameras and, you know, audio recorders where he didn't just, you know, not answer questions and pivot. He really, really struggled with that. He wasn't as smooth as, you know, some folks are when they're not answering questions. Richard Ervin has stumbled quite a few times. And, you know, when that's packaged into a, you know, campaign ad against him, that is effective. He couldn't walk this line. But, you know, again, I'm not sure that it was a line that could be walked in 2022, even in Illinois. And one thing I will point out, when we're talking about this most recent poll, this Sun-Times and BZ poll that shows this kind of staggering 2-1 lead that Darren Bailey has over Ervin versus, you know, other polls. Very importantly, all of those other polls that we have seen previously this spring, they had a sizable number of voters who said that they're undecided. These quote unquote undecided voters, it's not like they were between, oh, am I going to go with Richard Ervin or am I going to go with these others? I think that they're really between, am I going to go with Darren Bailey or these other more conservative candidates? And it seems that they've made up their minds. Of course, this is the outcome that Governor J.B. Pritzker kind of wanted from the beginning. And the Democratic Governors Association, of which, you know, J.B. Pritzker has given a lot of money, has kind of engineered this outcome in a way with all of their campaign ads against Richard Ervin.
Jerry, is the Republican establishment in the state, the so-called old guard, or are they nervous right now, you think, when they're watching this and saying, hey, this could this could spell real disaster, not only for the governor's office for them, because it will be hard for Bailey to win statewide. I think most people would agree with that, not saying he couldn't, but the it could certainly have a real effect down ballot, including in House and Senate races.
Yeah, you know, what's a couple of things on that point is Jim Durkin stood up in the State House Blue Room at one point with Senator Sue Resin, and maybe it was just the two of them. And he said, I said, you know, why are you up here supporting Mayor Irvin instead of Darren Bailey, who's, you know, your former colleague, Leader Durkin, and your current colleague, Senator Resin? And Durkin looked and smiled and said, Irvin is the only one who could win in the general election. So that's the thinking. But, you know, these polls are quite astounding, especially, I think, I always look at favorability and unfavorability, and the fact that Bailey had a 57% favorability and just 16% unfavorability among the Republican voters, whereas it was a 53% unfavorability for Irvin compared to 35% favorable. That's pretty astounding. And I think Hannah's right that the DGA ads and the other negative attacks on Irvin played a role in that, but also probably his own press conferences played a role in that. I don't want to put the cart ahead of the horse here, but you got to figure if Bailey gets a win in the primary, should this poll be anywhere near accurate, that he's going to take on the establishment. And you wonder what that means for Leader Durkin in the General Assembly. He's been the longest term leader in the General Assembly at this point. I know Rep. Tony McCombie at one point had considered challenging his leadership. Will he face more of that pushback moving forward if the party goes largely toward Bailey? You figure you might see some of that level of change come to the General Assembly. Yep. But there's a lot to be seen at this point.
You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford, along with Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and Jerry Nowicki with Capital News Illinois. Charlie, would you agree? I mean, we could see a seismic shift here if Darren Bailey's able to pull this out in a primary.
Well, if the poll is to be believed, and one thing we should probably make mention of is that all of these polls come with what's known as a 95% confidence level. And what that means is that 95 times out of 100, if you were to poll everybody, you get results that are within the margin of error. But what it also means is that one out of every 20 polls is totally wacko. And so you never know which one is going to be the one that's wacko. So with that caveat, if these numbers hold up, it really would represent a change in what the Republican Party traditionally has been in the state of Illinois. And I think back on the Republican governors that I covered as a reporter, people like Richard Ogilvie or Jim Thompson or Jim Edgar, they probably would not be considered Republicans by what appears to be the current cult-like behavior of a lot of the Republican electorate. They would be seen as what's called RINO, a Republican in name only, because they don't pledge fealty to our dear leader, former President Donald Trump. And so, yeah, this is a seismic shift. And what it means for the Republicans is I think they're kind of consigning themselves to permanent minority status, because they are not going to be able to win, I don't believe, with those kinds of policies in the places where the Illinois population is growing, namely the suburban area around the city of Chicago. Yeah, they'll do fine in downstate rural areas, but unfortunately those areas are losing population. So as I see it, the current trajectory of the Republican Party is to kind of be sort of always the backbenchers and never really have much say in what happens in Illinois.
Hannah, we mentioned at the start of the show that Richard Irvin is changing strategy, and it involves a lot of his television advertising. What exactly are we hearing that is going to happen there?
Well, his camp says that he's going to have some new ads out. But for now, he's kind of going back to some ads that he had earlier in the cycle, more positive ads, I should say, that, you know, introduce him as a person. You know, one of the things that I found really interesting is that, you know, he has a really compelling story, but really he's spent his time and effort not introducing himself as a person, which I wonder is a mistake, because voters want to connect to a story. They want to connect to a person, you know, whether that's good or bad. You know, we have been kind of conditioned and habituated to expect from our politicians some sort of human connection. We can debate, you know, the effects of that another time. But so he's going back to introducing who he is, his story as, you know, coming from Aurora, from a poor family, a single mother, you know, going to college on the GI Bill, you know, being a prosecutor, because for so much of this spring, Irvin has focused on this crime issue that, you know, I don't know if it's, again, kind of collective voter amnesia, just so many things have happened. But this crime issue that, you know, he thought was going to be so potent. I mean, when I say he, I really mean campaign strategists, just has not really borne out. We've seen that in other polls that we've talked about in the last few weeks on this program. But, you know, so he's also, like we heard at the top of the program, pulled his ads from downstate because, you know, really that's not, it's a third of the state's population, you know, just about in the city of Chicago, Cook County, you know, another third in the suburbs, and really just a third or less in downstate. So that's not where he wants to focus his energies. But of course, as Charlie pointed out, even in the suburbs, Irvin seems to be losing to Bailey, which I would add is surprising.
What Hannah mentioned, the traditional view of the three parts into which Illinois is divided, to paraphrase Caesar, actually in the Republican voting records for primaries, the people in 2018 and 2020 who asked for Republican ballots, more than half of them, in fact, 60% 2 years ago, lived outside of the Chicago area. They lived in the what we refer to as the 96 downstate counties, not in Chicago or in DuPage or Lake or McHenry, Kane or Will, but they lived in one of the other counties. So it surprised me to hear that Irvin's people were kind of abandoning the area outside the metropolitan Chicago region, because that's where the bulk of the Republican primary vote has been the last two elections.
Jerry, before we leave this topic, I look back and I'm thinking to myself, should we be surprised that somebody that's considered more conservative may be winning in these polls and may be even able to pull this out? I mean, you look back to the last gubernatorial race on the Republican side, and Jeannie Ives, pretty conservative. She nearly knocked off the incumbent governor, Bruce Browner.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because it was Richard Uihlein who was largely funding Ives in that effort. And some of the ads she did were kind of eye-popping, but it was roughly around 48% of the vote that she got against an incumbent, no less. So, no, I don't think we should be surprised. I think kind of what's surprising here is that it was such an establishment push for Irvin. And these poll numbers suggest there's a real pushback against that. So, you know, it's just something that we're going to have to watch. We'll see if any change in strategy can move this. And as Charlie said, you never know with polls, but this is pretty staggering.
Well, let's take a look at a few of the congressional races, kind of from an overall standpoint. Hannah, you've been following these. Point out what's going on in a couple of those right now for us.
Yeah, I think we can do some more next week on the show, but I wanted to highlight two. I want to talk about what's going on up in the 6th congressional district, I should say really the newly redrawn 6th congressional district, because so much of this territory is new to both the incumbent, Sean Casten, who is now in his second two-year term in Congress, and his progressive challenger, Marie Newman, who is currently the congresswoman from the 3rd congressional district. Newman got basically remapped out of her district, kind of a freshman drawing the short straw, but also there had been internal issues with her demanding some things that Democrats in Springfield just could not or were unwilling to give to her in the remapping process. You know, we talk about changing Republican Party, and which we'll also, talk about when we talk about the 15th congressional district, the Mary Miller, Rodney Davis matchup. But, the Democratic Party has had its own kind of identity issues too. And I think that this is a very interesting kind of matchup. The two of them, former allies, obviously colleagues, just the mudslinging and the ads that they have launched against each other have been pretty extreme. Marie Newman, like I said, a freshman progressive Democrat, she has gained a lot of cachet, I would say, around the country. She is one of these progressives who took on an establishment Democrat, in her case, Dan Lipinski, who had served in the 3rd congressional district for years, took over for his father, who had served that district for decades. Dan Lipinski was one of these, very dwindling numbers of, he would call himself a pro-life Democrat, that did not sit well with a changing electorate, at least in those who are active in Democratic primaries, as the progressive wing of the party gains more and more power. So Marie Newman tried to take on Lipinski in 2018, lost, and then had a matchup in 2020. But something that was revealed, and a former would-be challenger sued Newman, basically said, hey, we had an agreement that I would not run against you in 2020, and then you would hire me. Ended up not being hired, was sued, all this dirty laundry was aired. But also, it turns out this is not the most ethical thing to do. So the Office of Congressional Ethics basically has said since then, the lawsuit has since been settled, that, this is not, there's credible information here, and this is really on the border. That's kind of still playing out. But, another thing that came out in the fall was that as part of this alleged agreement, Newman would take kind of anti-Israel stances in Congress. There's this PAC that is, basically Democrats for Israel. They have launched at least one attack ad. There are maybe more waiting in the wings against Newman. And again, just the level of mudslinging here between Democrats, you have to wonder what it might do to the party long term, just as we're seeing play out on the Republican side.
And Charlie, before we started the show, just real quickly, you mentioned you're not really paying a lot of attention to these congressional primaries because most of these are in districts that are not going to flip party come the general election, so they won't really have a whole lot of impact on the state's total delegation count.
Yeah, and both the ones that Hannah mentioned, whether it's Casten or Newman, to use the old cliche, the odds of a Republican winning in that district are about as likely as me being the next manager of the White Sox, to kind of update my favorite cliche. And in the district involving Mary Miller and Rodney Davis, whichever prevails in the primary can just mail it in from that point, because they will be the next congressman from that newly created district. And in Newman's case, she was like the rookie on the squad. And when it came time to draw a congressional district, a second congressional district with a Hispanic voting population sufficient for the Latinos to elect a congressman of their choice, she drew the short straw, and a district was crafted, and her home was in that district, but it was majority Latino, And so she had to decide, do I want to run in the primary and get beaten probably by Hispanic, or do I want to decide to run in the next door district against Kasten, which is what she chose to do. But I think more than anything else, the fact that she was a freshman is the one, she was the one who got kind of mapped out of the picture.
All right, time now for our notes from the field. Jerry, let's go to you first.
Yeah, the state comptroller, Susana Mendoza, announced yesterday she put another $320 million in the rainy day fund, which brought its balance to about $750 million, which is about three times the height of where it's ever been. So for the first time, really, once another deposit is made after July 1, the balance will be over $1 billion.
Okay. Hannah?
Some late breaking news on Thursday evening. A new search warrant was unsealed in the federal case against Mike McLean, former House Speaker Mike Madigan's kind of right-hand man confidant, those who were associated with ComEd, who were all charged together in November 2020. New records that were unsealed that give further texture and color to the lengths to which Madigan and his allies went again. His own daughter, former Attorney General Lisa Madigan, and her signature piece of legislation that she wanted on her way out of office in 2018 that would have kind of curtailed these what are called like alternative rate suppliers. The conversations saying from McLean telling a former ComEd CEO Anne Pramaggiore, you know, we have to kill this, et cetera. And then another conversation, you know, unsealed between McLean and Andrew Madigan, another of the Madigan children. Very interesting stuff. We continue to see this saga unfold.
Okay. And Charlie.
Well, we've talked in the past about the effort to give the state an official state rock. Well, it is now culminated. Governor Pritzker last week signed legislation saying that our state rock is going to be Dolostone. And that's as a result of an initiative brought by a couple groups of school children up in the western suburbs who put together a kind of a statewide referendum to vote for a state rock. And Dolostone beat out sandstone and limestone. And Dolostone is kind of the remnants of what Illinois was like 400 million years ago when we were a tropical sea. And it's made up of the crushed former bodies of all the types of life that lived there. Corals, what today would be considered clams, oysters, those kinds of things. And it's what most of the bedrock in Illinois is. And as a kind of a historic note, some 3,300 dolomite stones were used to build the old state capitol in Springfield. So, Dolomite, welcome to the pantheon of official Illinois symbols.
And rock on there. That's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and Jerry Nowicki of Capital News Illinois. Get a podcast of our show. It's available at nprillinois.org through the NPR One app or iTunes. And look for State Week. I'm Sean Crawford. Join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.